to be back here. I think things change in the perimeter faster than you can keep up, right? And today I had the pleasure of seeing that there was already a picture of me in the visitors because it's kept from the previous time. And that picture, the guy in the picture doesn't get older, but I do, right? So if I keep coming back, I will always be seeing this guy in the picture that looks younger. And also, I have to say that it's quite exciting for you guys that the Shaogang is coming here. It's a great loss for the Boston area in general, but I think that would be fantastic, both for him and for you guys. And there's also, that's my former advisor, there's an advisee of mine who's coming here next year too, Luis Santos, and a very pleasant guy. I hope that you enjoy him as well. So today I'm going to be talking about virtual parallel computing with matrix product states. And this is work that done with Eduardo Mucciolo at UCF. There's a very recent preprint of in February where we wrote up these results, and I'll have much more to talk about here today. So okay, so let me start with some motivation, okay? And I'm going to start being very naive here, but let's start with a thing. You know, you can simulate, and simulating here meaning like finding physical properties, like calculating the energies, correlation functions of one-dimensional spin chains very efficiently, okay, with methods like DMRG. And here we have some of the world's experts sitting here. And it's efficient, but let's see, what are the reasons for success? And I'll list three, and it's actually, the real reason is not within these three, but maybe you could say physically they are important ones. Low spatial dimension, it's 1D, local interactions, and a gapped spectrum. But the underlying reason is really that the entanglement is slow, and it's kept low. So the resources you need to find good variational states are not growing exponentially in the size of your system. And it's often said that the reason for the success is that you're keeping the information that you need in a very compressed way with matrix product states, for example. And that's okay because you're only interested in a small corner of the Hilbert space, as it's often called. Now, let's ask the following question. Could you use DMRG to mimic a quantum computer? Very naively, okay? And of course, the answer that for that, you say it's no, and the reason is entanglement. But let's keep going. Okay, first of all, one route to do this would be to put quantum computation on a line, and this is something that was done by Aronov, Gottsman, Irani, and Kemp in 2009 that you can basically translate and that a quantum, for example, a quantum adiabatic algorithm can be mapped into a problem of a Hamiltonian on a line where you have to keep something like 9 states per site. And there's a, you know, more recently, there is a paper where the MIT group, they studied this random QDIT line, and they basically are asking the question, okay, if you have a random Hamiltonian with a Q here, meaning that's not a Q bit, sorry, the DIT, it's a D-dimensional. So if, for example, take D equals 9 states per site, and how does the entanglement grow? If you try to write the ground state of such a Hamiltonian as a function as you propagate, say if you fix a boundary condition in the beginning of the line. So that would be one way to try to mimic a quantum computer using a classical computer. In this case, they're just looking at a ground state property. Another way is if you do time evolution, and so you can basically start with a state and try to evolve it as a function of time. And that's, for example, we can use TEBD to do that. And Let me discuss the setup here of the compression of the data using matrix products. So imagine you take states writable in 1D. You can always write something like this, that your state, you compress your wave function by writing as a trace of matrices in the x1, x2, et cetera. Here, we'll take values as 0 and 1. And you have a matrix for 0 and a matrix for 1. They are different at each site. And this way, you could write a state. And for example, if it's a unitary evolution, you could break out the unitary evolution in short times, write everything in terms of operations that act on two qubits, neighboring qubits at a time, and evolve the matrices as a function of time. And the idea is that if you take two matrices and you evolve with a two-qubit gate, there is a procedure how to take the matrices at time t and get the matrices at time t plus 1 by first assembling out of your unitary evolution another matrix, a bigger matrix, using singular value decomposition and truncation if it is used. And you get back, if you use truncation, the matrices of similar ranks, or otherwise the ranks grow. Mm-hmm. In 1D, yes. You know, of course, the matrix could be humongous, but you can always take. You know, it's actually one way you can do is just taking matrices which are okay. That's a very inefficient way, but you could take a matrix which is basically the size of the Hilbert space, and take them to be diagonal, etc. But that's not an efficient way. But you can always do in 1D. Yeah, you can probably But then, of course, the tensor ranks grow. Well, you can write any.
It will be useful in 1D, but what you were saying does not make use of the 1D.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, what I would say special in 1D is that when you do contractions of matrices, the matrix multiplication gives you another matrix, and it doesn't grow the rank. So that's something that, that is peculiar to 1D. But now, you could ask, why can't we use this to simulate a quantum computer? Well, the problem is that the entanglement is going to grow as a function of time evolution. And you're going to, you hit the wall. And maybe at one point in the talk, I'll make the comment, but if it were possible to evolve, to simulate a quantum computer doing this, I would argue that you can prove that P equals NP. And you see why you will come out of the discussion of how we use certain algorithms to do search, et cetera. And you could map things into CSAT. But yes, we're going to hit the wall. But, okay, this is just to say for there's so many experts in the audience, but the singular value decomposition or the Schmidt decomposition is basically the idea that if you give any matrix, you can always write as a product of U, lambda, and V. Lambda is diagonal, contains the singular values. And often when we say, okay, we're gonna break a matrix into product of two, it's because we take the matrix in the middle and you can absorb it either on the one on the left, on the right, on the left, or take the square root if these lambdas are, for example, if they're all positive, and which will be the case for us. And you absorb half of it in one, half of it in the other. In other words, it's a way to, given a matrix, break it as a product of two other matrices. Okay. The rank of the matrix is the number of singular values. It's possible to truncate. This is at the heart of the efficiency of many of these algorithms. But let me raise a question now. Okay, what is it that gives a quantum computer its power? Well, we could say parallelism. That's the that's naive thing. Well, indeed, a quantum computer can run many things in parallel. A quantum computer doesn't care about the growth of entanglement; it just deals with it. That's quantum mechanics. But parallelism kind of gives its power. But there are problems, and the problem is the measurement. So let's discuss this point because this is it is the essence of why we could benefit from doing evolutions, studying the problem In a classical computer, there are things that we can get that we cannot get in a quantum computer. Let me qualify the statement. Of course, you can simulate a classical computer in a quantum computer, but there are things in this method. So we're not going to be able to do anything that in a classical computer that a quantum computer wouldn't do. But first of all, we don't have one yet. Second, I don't know if we're going to have one before I die. And if one can actually use ideas that were developed in quantum information to guess better algorithms for classical algorithms than the ones we already have, that's a game. So that's the idea. But one reason why it's so hard to find algorithms or find problems for which quantum computers are good is that even though they can do things in parallel, at the end of the day, you're going to do a measurement. And you're going to project into one of the results. It's not that you're going to have the probabilities at the end of the day. You're just going to have, they're there, but you measure, you get one. And what's so special about Shor is that it manages to put these probabilities in such a way that whatever peak you measure from whatever you got in that measurement, you can use that information, okay, for doing, say, order finding. But in most cases, you do evolve in parallel, okay? You have all the results there, but you have all the results with certain probabilities. You measure, you get one, only one. Now, can we find inspirations from quantum systems to improve classical algorithms? Well, let's see. Can we do some kind of parallelism? Can we evolve all the outcomes at one using, say, matrix products? Or maybe perhaps we can improve things. Of course, we won't beat the quantum computer. We're not crazy here. But there's things that we can have in the scheme that I'm going to discuss that you don't have in a quantum computer. And again, that doesn't mean that we can do things that a quantum computer doesn't do, but it can help our thinking of algorithms. For example, if you think about evolution using, say, TEBD, at the end of the day, if you chose a state, you could compute the amplitude of that state, okay, for any state you want. But there's no measurement there. Like, okay? Any state you want, you have that information, okay? And this has value. So what we'll be using is the fact that at the end of the computation, even though we're limited by the growth of entanglement, you have access to probabilities. And we can, if we use that in a smart way, maybe we can improve certain algorithms. So what is our method? Okay, first I'm going to describe what is, exactly like what one would use in a TBD. It's just that we're going to work with probabilities as opposed to amplitudes. That's the first thing. But this is just setting up until we get to the search. There is nothing really earth-shaking here. But the idea is that first we're going to consider a bit of bits. We will think about them as classical bits, and there will be a matrix for the bit one, matrix for the bit zero. And if you take the trace of the products of these, we're going to encode the probability. So the idea is that the matrix product state is a way to do compression, to have all the probabilities written in a concise way. Associated with each matrix, just like in the quantum case, there is a bond dimension. In the matrix dimensions, we can avoid taking the trace if the first one is a column matrix and the last one is a vector matrix, as usual, right? That way we can encode all possible bit strings at once, okay, all the 2 to the n. And here is something, the configuration probability, so not the amplitude, the probability, but there's no problem working with probabilities instead of amplitudes. So the probability for any one given configuration will be encoded and compressed in terms of a product of matrices for a given sequence of zeros and ones. You multiply the matrices, and if you chose your normalization correctly, this probability would add up to one. So the probability, you can normalize it from the beginning. And the normalization, if you ask, okay, what is the, say, the partition function, if you hadn't normalized it, you can compute it very easily. You can just take the product of the matrices, you know, M0, M1, for all of them. When you expand, you get all possible outcomes of the X1, X2, XN, and you add them up, that will give you a partition function. So in particular, if you normalize the matrix such that Z equals 1, you don't even have to worry about normalizing afterwards. So, and the sum of the probabilities add up to 1. Now, as we see, you can evolve the matrices with gates. And here, gates don't have to be unitary. Okay, they can be things like the usual NAND gate in classical computation. But the thing is that if you take a state and you evolve, think about this as a transfer matrices that you evolve from one time to another. If your transfer matrices are such that the probability is conserved, okay, and that basically, there are certain constraints in which matrices you're going to use for our gates. We're going to get to that, but probability will be conserved at all times. So the matrices will evolve, but the normalization is maintained. Maybe I should stop. Is it clear so far? How are we encoding the?
So these gates are stochastic.
They're stochastic matrices. So there actually will be. We're going to use 2-bit deterministic gates, and actually we also discussed the 1-bit probabilistic gates, but we're only going to use it to set up the initial state, but they'll all be deterministic gates. Okay, so let me use that as an example. So suppose you take a bit 0 and with probability p goes to 0, with probability 1 minus p, bit 0 will be flipped to 1. Bit 1 with probability 1 minus q goes to 0, and with probability q, 1 goes to 1. There is a transfer matrix, okay, this little t matrix with all the entries and that are given by these rates. And for example, an operation, a time evolution of using a 1-bit matrix, I'll have the dm at one time, and I just have to sum using this transfer matrix, and I'll get the matrix at the next time. And you can check that because if I sum these two guys, I get 1. If I sum these guys, I get 1. That this evolution will conserve probabilities. Okay. And some examples, of course, you know, the NOT gate. We can just take that if I have a bit 1, it's going to go to 0 in the next clock cycle. If I have a bit 0, it goes to 1. That's one example. If I set P equals Q equals 0. A RAND gate, which is a randomizer, whatever bit I have, I take my, you know, if I write this, P equals Q equals a half, I just take my two matrices, add them up, divide by 2, and set that equal to both M tilde 0 and M tilde 1. That basically is equivalent to, looking at this equation, to take P and Q equals a half. So if I have a bit 0, I randomize it to be 0 and 1, and same thing for bit 1. Now the important ones, the 2-bit gates. They're deterministic, and if I have 2 bits, you know, A and B here are 0 and 1, and there are like 2 outputs, the capital A and the capital B. So just to give a concrete, you have the 2 input. There are 4 possible configurations between these A's and B's, and here they're the transfer matrix for the A tilde B tilde. If this guy's deterministic, this capital T, the transfer matrix, will be 1 if the output bits are given by these functions of the 2 input bits, and 0 otherwise. This is the relationship between the old bit matrices and the new ones. They're going to have to satisfy this product of the 2 new ones are related to this combination of the old matrices. And this is very much like, for example, if you're doing unitary evolution, say with the TBD, there would be something similar, but instead of being some matrix that satisfies some rules here, and it's not necessarily unitary, you substitute that by some unitary transformation. Okay, so you have to, out of generating this guy, you have to find a way to break into the two M's. That you can do with the SVD. Again, this is a standard. And usually the bond dimension will grow. So just as an example, a NAND gate. And here I'm going to use a NAND gate that has two entries and two exits. And the DA would just go unchanged, just like a control bit in a CNOT, for example. So the A bit goes unchanged, and the B will contain the A, the NAND of A and B. So that particular case corresponds to a certain transfer matrix, which has these entries here equal to 1 and everything else equal to 0. These guys I can read out of the truth table. So notice here that I have, basically this is A and B. This is A tilde, B tilde. A is just a copy. This column here is just a copy of the first column. And the second column is the NAND of these two bits. Okay? And out of this guy, we read the transfer matrix. For example, 0, 0 going to 0, 1 is a 1 because it is in the truth table. So you fill this guy. Just from the truth table, you get the transfer matrix. And you can compose a big matrix that you're going to have to break into using the singular value decomposition. And for example, let me explain this entry here, 0. Well, this entry 0 means that if you look at this truth table, there's nothing here that has a 0, 0. And that's why this guy is 0. And these things come in out of using the transfer matrix. And out of that, you do a singular value, and you get the new matrices. Okay? And the new matrices, the bond dimensions there are going to change, and they tend to grow. So that's, nothing new so far. One thing that we can do here, and usually if you're going to translate a classical computation, you give me an algorithm with NAND gates, and sometimes I need to insert a bit, sometimes I have to remove a bit. So how do we insert a bit? Well, I can go in the middle between these two matrices here, insert a new matrix, and this new matrix that I insert there, I would like to insert in such a way that, for example, when this bit is 0, I just get the same probability as before, and when it's 1, it gives me 0. I can do this in this way. The new matrix that I insert in the middle is the identity matrix for 0, and for 1 is just a null matrix. That's one way to grow my chain and put a bit that's set to 0. Without changing any of the other ones. It's just that supposedly in the middle of the calculation, I need to bring another auxiliary bit, okay? I can do that by inserting this identity matrix. And I bring this bit set to 0. Bit erasure, that's easy. I just have to trace out. So if I want to erase this bit, I don't need it anymore. What I can do, well, it's basically erasing a bit is like tracing it out. So I will combine this guy into some, this product into some new product that has only one matrix, and that's easy. I just, tracing it means that I sum over all configurations where that bit was 0 and 1. I just add the two matrices, multiply on the matrix on, say, on the left, and I get my new matrix, which is obtained by tracing out the bit. So I can throw out things. Okay, so far, that's just the an algorithm to evolve. And you can think about this as you're evolving things by looking at the compressed state with the matrices, okay? So let me discuss a search algorithm. And this is where the new ideas come in and how to use the fact that we have this in a classical computer. We have access to the probabilities. What could we do that with this access to the probabilities? So suppose you have a problem that's stated in the following way. You have some function y equals f of x that can be computed algorithmically, with NAND gates, just the usual, think that they have a circuit that computes y given x, and it can be implemented with some you know, polynomial number of gates, and we'll discuss the things about the value of p later, but suppose that you have some algorithmic function. Well, you can break it into a sequence of gates like the ones we discussed before, and we can compute the evolution of the matrices. And but suppose that the problem you're interested in is not that, okay, given x getting y, that's easy. The inverse problem is hard, okay? Tell me a y, which x is such that f of x is equal to that y? So we will fix one value of y, and we want to find an x star such that this is satisfied. Now, it's very important here that I'm interested in one value of y star. Of course, if I'm interested in all values of y, then I have an exponentially large problem, no matter what. But I'm interested in one y. I just want to find out the next star, and maybe later we're going to discuss counting the number of solutions. Okay, here standard shouldn't be
1x.
Get at least 1x. It could there could be many x, yeah, right? But we fixed one y. So one approach, which is kind of you know, the most obvious, is that, well, you just test all values of x until you hit the y star. You compute f of x and hit y star. Of course, this is going to take two to the n, because you have to check, if you have n bits, all the x. So that's not very clever. Okay, now let's look at what the fact that we have this state compressed as an MPS state, how that can help us. Well, suppose you enter just a simple product state of all zeros and ones. Okay, that's your initial state. You evolve, you compute them, you update the matrices, okay? And you're only updating the matrices. You apply all the gates that defines your function f of x, and at the end of the day, you have some you know, set of 2n matrices, you know? For each bit, you have a matrix for 0, matrix for 1. Now, you're interested only a given y, only one. So you can very efficiently multiply these matrices and find P of y, which is an integer divided by 2 to the n. This integer is actually the number of solutions, okay? Because it's a probability. So if you enter all these 2 to the n solutions, some of them are going to hit y star, some others will not. You know, the probability will be the number of solutions, the number of x's that hit that, divided by 2 to the n. Okay, so you have the probability. So what we're going to do is that we're going to modify bit by bit by computing the probability, repeating this thing until we find which value of x will hit that. I'll show you that in detail in the next slide. Sorry?
What is the connection between f of x and the gate operation?
Oh, okay, because the function f of x, mm-hmm, I can write as a sequence of gates.
I see.
So, you know, any algorithm function I can write using NAND gates and...
Sorry, can you say again what you meant by the last sentence?
I'll show you in the next slide.
Okay,
so I'll tweak bits until I find a solution. It's not clear from here, but
But so far you've had the superposition of all possible x's.
That's right. And then I'm going to go away from that.
And yep. Now you want to have the specific x system. Okay.
Yeah. So let me give it as an example. So suppose I have a circuit, okay, with the gates here. I start with everybody 0. I pass to a rand. Okay, so when I start with everybody 0, okay, all the matrix M0 are 1. Okay, just a number, so 1 by 1 matrix. M1 is 0. Then you pass through the rand gate, and you have this product state, okay? And again, think these are probabilities. That's why the normalization may look funny if you think in terms of quantum states, but these are probabilities, okay? So if I expand these guys, I have an equal probability superposition of all the, you know, here, things can be zeros and ones. This is equivalent to say that the matrix for 0 and the matrix for 1 both of them are just a number, one half, one by one matrix. Then in the first shot, you do your evolution, use your single value decompositions, et cetera. You get your final output matrices, and you compute the probability for a given y. Okay, one given y, having knowing the matrices, you multiply them, take the don't need to take the trace because of column and vector at the ends. But you have something like this, s divided by 2 to the n. S is the number of solutions, okay, number of possible x's that will land you here, but we don't know yet which x. We're interested in one at least, so that's a search, okay, that's fine. So now, if s were 0, we already know that the problem has no solution. But suppose that if s is not 0, we're gonna like start searching for the solution. So let's repeat the whole thing, but instead of randomizing everybody, let's just remove this ren here. So this bit is set to 0. Everybody else is set to, superposition. And you repeat, again, compute the matrices and compute the probabilities. So here, actually, it should have been 2 to the n minus 1. But you have this S1. Now, there are two possibilities. If you didn't have any solutions, you should have stopped already. But suppose you have one solution, or suppose you have some solutions. But now that you set this guy to 0, okay, you want to know if those solutions can have that bit as 0. Two possibilities. If S1 is bigger or equal to 1, well, okay, that's okay. Let's keep X1 equals 0. There are solutions that have X1 equals 0. If S1 is less than 1, and here by less, I mean, okay, well, if you're not throwing any any singular values so far, this everything's exact. These guys actually will be integers, so by S1 being less than 1 means S1 equals 0. Well, if it's 0, it means that now you don't have solutions. Before you had solutions, now you don't have any more. So you made a mistake in setting this guy to 0. Well, we go and we set it to 1 then. We know that this bit should be 1 if this is the case. If this is the case, we know that it's okay. We keep it at 0. So we found out already the first bit of x, bit x1. Then you repeat it. The next turn, you remove the first one so you can tell which bit this is. You do it again, you will find out what x2 is, etc. At the end of the day, you found one solution of the problem. How many steps did it take? Let's look at the computational cost. Okay, the main problem you see, okay, will come from the singular value decomposition, okay? That it goes as a d cube, and we're gonna have to do this for ng. Ng is the number of gates in computing the function f. So the bottleneck is going to be in the maximum bound dimension. So to compute the function f of x, the cost will be the number of gates times the maximum bound dimension that you face there, and it will go as d cube. Now, in the search algorithm, we had to repeat it because we had to set bit by bit to find the x. So we had to do this n times. So you actually have a cost for doing the search is just a little n in front. So you see that the real cost is coming from the singular value. Okay, the fact that we're doing the search, it just gives a polynomial cost. So that's very different than the.
This is the maximum
of the DIs. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Guarantee that you get a solution?
It's going to be exponential as a function of time. Yeah, that would be unavoidable. So, I'm going slow here. There are things, I'm not trying to sell snake oil, okay? I know that there are issues, that it's the growth. But then the question is, which cases can we do something, okay? What are the cases that this can actually lead to a speed up? And I think that's the heart of the problem. And even in the case when it's exponential, the question is, what's the prefactor in the exponential? Because if you think about it, even things like Grover is just a prefactor in that exponent. So
But do you have examples?
I'll get to first the analysis of what is the limit of the number of gates. Let me move on. But I just want to be aware that this doesn't, there are limitations, okay? But there are things that having the states, having access to the probabilities, can help build some certain algorithms. Okay, so given a function f of x, how does d scale with the number of gates and the number of bits? Okay. Okay, so first of all, this is the answer. Okay, given the number of gates and number of bits, the maximum d is this expression. So here you can see two things. Of course, it saturates as 2 to the n over 2. And for the experts in the audience, you know that, okay, well, if you have a chain, the maximum entanglement is going to be at the center. And that's the bond dimension. Now, how it grows with the number of gates, that's the other thing. So you cannot get to that if you have few gates. It takes a certain number of gates to get there. And also, as we'll discuss a little later, that we can identify what are the bad fellows, what are the gates that create the most entanglement, okay? If you translate the usual computation.
Claudio, mm-hmm. Are you allowing for gates to be applied in parallel? Because if you can slice all the gates into time steps that are not causally connected, then probably you can reduce the number.
You can reduce the number of gates, yeah.
By the number of time slices.
Yeah, this is the very worst case. Okay.
So you make them, they are sequential. The gates are sequential.
Actually, this bound, okay, I can show the bound. You see how we prove the bound. It's
basically how much time you can generate.
Yeah. If you do them in parallel, I can see even if you do them in parallel, if you do them in parallel, for example, you're going to grow the entanglement by one step, right? But for the worst cases, I think this still gets it because, for example, it says that in the worst case scenario, you need order n squared to get to the maximum entanglement.
All I'm saying is that if you measure, instead of the number of gates, you measure the number, you organize your circuit. Mm-hmm. Your circuit is fixed, but now you identify sequences of gates that you can apply in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
Then the number of sequences is the one that will determine.
That's right.
The circuit, not the number of gates.
Right.
So your number of gates in some cases can be divided by the number of qubits in mm-hmm. the expression. But
okay, so, let me just count how in the worst case scenario, how does dimension grow? But these are things that, you have an intuition for that. But let me just go over them reasonably quickly. So when you apply the gate, you have to have this step, which is a singular value. You build a bigger matrix and then you do the singular value decomposition. You want to see how this d tilde in the next step grows. Well, when you use a singular value, let's just look at the rank of this matrix that you have to assemble. It will be 2, the dimension on the left, on this side here. Okay, what's the rank of these things? When you multiply these matrices, these are each block here is di minus 1 by di plus 1. And you have a factor of 2 because of you built this big block. So this matrix here is 2di minus 1 by 2di plus 1. When you do the singular value, this value here will be the minimum of these two, right? So di will be, in the worst case scenario, of course, okay, if you don't throw out any eigenvalues, if you don't get exactly 0, if the rank of the matrix is as bad as it gets, that's the bound, that's the worst case. Now, there's, at least in the way that we counted, there's something interesting. There's a connection to a height model. So if you define the h to be log base 2 of di, you can think about the growth of entanglement as the growth of some heights. So if I translate this equation, this guy using this log, I get that the hi, if I apply a 2-bit gate here, hij tilde would be the minimum of the heights on the left and on the right plus 1. So it's because of this plus 1 that things tend to grow. But you take the minimum of the neighbors and you add 1. The minimum because in the singular value, take the rank of the smallest. So you can think about the evolution of entanglement as the evolution of the heights. Now, there are some things that are interesting to show in terms of the heights. First, that whatever height profile you have, the height difference between two neighbors can never be bigger than 1. And you can prove this very easily. It's okay, it's by induction. First, you start with your initial state, which is a product state, all heights are 0. And if the condition, this guy, is satisfied at step tau, it's going to be satisfied at step tau plus 1. And just by example, okay, there are 9 cases because if you fix a height in the guy in the middle, there are 2 possibilities, plus or minus 1 or 0 for the left and the right. So for example, in this case, this is a height, this height in the middle, and the next, the neighbor. If I apply the condition of the minimum plus 1, here you see that all the differences is the difference in consecutive heights is it's always smaller than 1. But if I apply the gate, the minimum plus 1 is this guy, and the condition is also satisfied at a later time. So you can show that this condition is satisfied at all times. Now, this involves only the 2-bit gates. What about if I need to use bit insertions or deleting bits? A bit insertion, you always insert an identity with the same rank as before. So you won't change the constraint, okay? You're just gonna get the same dimensions that your neighbor had. So the delta h is gonna be 0. Bit removals are trickier because, for example, if I trace bits 4, 5, 6, if I trace things around here, for example, I can imagine a jump in height of 2 that violates the constraint. But that can be cleaned up by applying identity gates. And I think that this is things that you're using TBD too, right? The cleanup, right? And so then you restore the condition of h plus or minus 1 or 0. Maximum change in height. Now suppose I'm going to apply a gate. What is the worst possible case? Okay, the worst possible case is when the height associated to this bond is smaller than the two neighbors, because when you apply the gate, the minimum plus 1 jumps here. So that's how it jumps by 2. So out of this, I can see that as a function of time evolution, the change in height is always less than or equal to 2. Okay. And therefore, the area under this height curve, the sum over all heights, has to be always smaller or equal to 2 times the number of gates. Because the worst possible case, and so this is the worst possible case, that every time you put a gate, the height on one side jumps by 2. So the area will also jump by 2 in the worst case scenario. Now, if you have that the height profile satisfies this constraint, that the slope cannot be bigger than 1, and the area, is smaller than this, you can show that the maximum height that you can possibly attain is the minimum of these two quantities. And this guy, you can understand why. Okay, well, if your slope is at most 1, the worst thing you can do is like climb at a constant rate, hit the middle of the chain and climb down, because the boundary condition is that the bond dimensions in the beginning and the end are 0. Or 1, so the log is 1. Okay, so let me take this expression and go make a comment about some recent paper that Alyosha wrote, which is also related to a comment of Wifi. Take the uniform case that the number of gates, you spread it and you do it in parallel, n times tau. Tau, the number of layers. In this case, you see that to reach the maximum entanglement, in other words, to have like the square root of ng to be of order n, you need tau to be order n. So it takes time, at least the system size, the number of bits, to reach this maximum entanglement. Okay, let me go back to the estimation of how long it takes. So we go back to the, okay, this is an expression for the bond dimension. And now suppose that the number of gates is polynomial and it goes as n to the p. We have two scenarios, in the worst case scenarios, right? So one is that p is less than 2. If p is less than 2, this guy is smaller than this guy. So you're going to have the maximum dimension grows as a power n to the p over 2. And the algorithm cost is sub-exponential. Okay? So if you have less than order n square gates, and then, okay, this is the worst case scenario. You could imagine that there is an algorithm for which you have n to the fourth gates, but you haven't reached the maximum time. There's another scenario. That's one. Okay? This is the worst case scenario, but it's sub-exponential for the search. And if p is greater or equal to 2, in the worst case scenario, you are exponential. Okay? The maximum is this guy, and the algorithm cost is exponential. Now, the critical point is pc equals 2. Now, to make this comparison, you have to be a bit careful. Okay? But if your function can be computed with less than n squared gates, then this classical algorithm is better than Grover. Okay, so you should use this one instead of Grover. The catch is that, well, the way that Grover stated is very general. Okay, it's for an unstructured database. So you have this oracle for the function f. You don't care. Okay, you're going to evaluate in a quantum computer. You don't care if you have n squared and cube gates. Okay, it's for any power p. Okay, what we're saying here is that you can draw a line. You can say that well, if you really say, okay, well, as long as it's polynomial number of gates, it's one bag of cats, and it's, you know, it's the same thing. But if you refine a bit more and say, well, let's look at how many gates you have in your function f. If you have less than n squared, do it with the MPS. Okay, don't use Grover. Okay, now. The other comment is the following. Even when p is bigger than 2, and that's something that we're discussing with Alyosha, that we know that the bond dimension is going to go as an exponential, okay? Or the log of it is going to go as n over 2, but it's n over 2 times something, okay? It's just that you know that it's going to be extensive, okay? It's going to scale with n. But what is the prefactor? And here, maybe allow me to think as a, you know, more or less, more practically. If the prefactor for the given algorithm is small, it means that, yes, it grows exponentially. But if you use this type of search, okay, running in parallel, okay, it's not just like the standard search of find, run everything. Use the MPS. But if that prefactor in front of the n over 2 is, say, less than 1/3, then this thing is going to run faster than Grover. So we're talking about prefactors now. Okay. So in practice, it can actually be useful. The question is, okay, which problems fall into, you know, which fraction of the typical problem? And also, which fraction of the typical f, if it has p greater than 2, we'll have, this prefactor, smaller than, say, 1/3. And the 3 here is because of the G cube in the... Okay. But let me mention something else that is useful about this method. It's not just searching for the solutions, okay? We also can count them. And counting them is a hard problem. And again... You know, I'm not selling snake oil. I know the limitations. If the entanglement grows, things are going to be exponential, okay? But let me take an example of a problem, like two sets. Okay, two sets is in P. You can determine whether it's satisfiable or not. Most of you know, but let me mention for those who don't. The two set is a problem that you have n bits, and you have clauses that have... only 2 bits, and they're written in standard form, like you know, it's the 2 bits negated or not with an OR, and you end all these clauses. So this the problem where you have only 2 bits in one of the clauses, it's the 2-set, and in general it's the P set. 3-set and the P bigger than or equal to 3 is in NP, but 2-set is in P. But the problem of counting the solutions is actually a problem in sharp P. It's a very hard problem. Now, the thing about this is that you can count the number of solutions. Now, we're not going to say, okay, we're going to find the, first question, what we're working on now is to determine first how many gates in the random 2-set, okay, do you need to, you know, basically, what is the P that you need? And even if the P is bigger than 2, because we already did some analysis for the worst case scenario, counting the number of solutions, if you go in the Wikipedia, the page about 2-set, they have an exponent there. We think we estimated for the random 2-set, just by counting using properties about the connectivity of random graphs, etc., we think we got a coefficient smaller than that. So the problem is still exponential. Okay, we want, but we think that we can use this idea of computing with the matrix product states to maybe find better algorithms, even if they're exponential. Maybe we can lower the bound.
Mm-hmm.
In the 2-set, you mean?
Yeah, you're imposing clauses.
Yeah, the clauses are random. We take them at random, but the gates are deterministic.
But once you fix the clauses, how do you relate that those two gates? How do you map clauses into gates?
Okay. So, for example, if I have a clause like something like A or B bar, I just use the clause that I use is I can design a 2-bit gate.
Which will kill the state if there's no solution.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So since the transformation is not unitary, you actually is going to start like getting rid of solutions.
So the final wave function that you get, so to speak, is just a linear combination of the solutions with a very small problem, with whatever.
No, actually, in this case, I should say that. We thought about in the case of the 2-set, we should change the method a bit. Instead of thinking about the getting the probability, you kind of like do projections.
Right.
Exactly.
So that's what I was asking. So your gates this time are projecting out.
Exactly.
Whatever sequence that is invalidated by the clause.
Right. Okay. And then, of course, if you have enough clause, like you're just going to get rid of everybody.
Kill everything.
Right? Yeah.
But at the end of imposing all the clauses, you still have some.
Then you're going to count the survivors. And then you have the number of solutions.
Which is, again, n divided by 2 to the n.
Yeah.
N divided by 2 to the n.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more than like some things on the normalization, but it will be of that form.
Okay,
but now let me discuss a bit. What are the things that make some algorithms harder, to simulate using MPS, and which ones are easier? Let me give a physical interpretation for the bond dimension, at least from the perspective of classical circuits, okay? So first of all, let me revisit. Do we really need that NAND to be a 2-bit gate, okay? Well, some things we learned from experience. We realized that, okay, well, we don't really need it, okay? So suppose, okay, I go back to the truth table, right? And I have the NAND as a 2-bit gate. But suppose I just get rid of this copy. I really use I use the usual NAND. I'm going to get rid of a bit, okay? It's okay, because we know how to put insert bits if we need them. So let's just use the NAND as a really 2-to-1. In this case, the matrix, we're going to eliminate one bit. Of course, we're going to trace it out, and we know how to do that. And the bit, the matrix M tilde for this bit, I plus 1, is just that, okay? These are basically would account for the probability of this bit being 0. In the NAND, these two have to be 1, okay? And everybody else, it's 1. So in other words, let's think about the NAND as a...
I did not understand what you said. You said that you can later on, if you need to insert, the bit that you threw out.
I threw it out. The fresh one.
You can accept it only as fresh one.
Fresh one.
But you have lost.
Yeah, I have lost one.
So if you test this one out, you irreversibly.
Yes. Irreversible. So all this is not reversible. Yeah. Even with the 2-bit representation, this guy is irreversible.
Fair enough, but what I'm saying is that applying NAND is not the same as applying these other. I mean, applying the original NAND with 2 input and 2 output is not the same as applying the second one and adding a random bit.
It's not. Okay. Yeah, but the thing is that I in this NAND that we define. This guy just passed by. It's as if like I apply. It's not the same, but I kept a copy of this thing. But what I would like to do here is that say, suppose I get from an electro engineer a diagram for some circuit using NAND gates. They're going to have these guys. So what I'm saying is that I don't need to carry this guy. I don't need to use the NAND that we defined. Okay, we thought in the beginning that we needed it, but you can actually do without it.
Oh, provided that you don't care about one.
Provided we don't care about that.
Sure.
But in the circuit diagram of the engineer, usually they don't care about it. If they care about it, they will copy. But I'll have it in the next slide.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yes. So this guy here. Okay. So we can do everything with this, but we reversibly got rid of one. So here's the copy. But if I wanted a copy of that, I would use this fan out. And the fan out, what it is, okay, I didn't have a bit here. I can insert a bit set to 0, and then I'll have a copy gate. So I'll need a copy gate. And also, the other thing is the wire cross gate. So if you look at the circuit from a design of some chip, you could say, well, they have these guys, so I could use that to translate into the circuit we need. We need insertion and copy, and we need swap, and these are the only 2-bit gates that we need. And the NAND. Yeah, and the NAND. But then let's look at, what causes entanglement? If I look at this, there is a simple way to look at a circuit and say that it entangles. It's literally, it entangles means crossing of wires. So, this is not very clear, right? So let me say what it is. It's a bunch of gates here. Okay, there's an NAND, there's an XOR here. But imagine that you have a whole bunch of guys and you just kind of binary, like make a tree. And you never have any crossings of wires. So this circuit has no entanglement. Well, if you can look there, it looks a bit better. Right? So that guy has no crossings. Let me give you a circuit that from an electrical engineer perspective, it's a trivial circuit, no gates. Now this guy, can you see from here? Oh, if not, that's too bad because, okay. So from an electrical engineer perspective, this is a trivial circuit, but this is the worst possible thing for entanglement because you have lots of crossings, you're shuttling your bits across. And if I actually draw these little lines here, which are hard to see, I apologize, connecting, okay, this bit was copied to this one, so let's see, it's over here, the copy is over there. If you count the number of crossings of these dimers, you actually get, it's the entanglement here, like look, this is 0 cuts, 1, 2, 3, 4. You can actually see that you get exactly the maximum entanglement shape. So entanglement means if you look at a classical circuit, a circuit that is pretty bad is one that have many wires crossing. The number of NAND gates. So maybe if you ask the physicist to say, okay, how do you tell the complexity of a circuit? Maybe the right answer would be don't count the number of gates, count the number of wire crossings. Okay, if you had to pay money for the crossings, okay? Because if you don't have many crossings, like the previous case, this guy, it's easy.
This depends on the question you want to ask.
Right.
I mean, this considerations make sense if what you want is given a function,
mm-hmm.
you want to get, you want to know whether there is some y, some answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is some x that gives that particular y.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very particular question you're asking.
Okay, but let me tell why that's a good question to ask. Let me substantiate. I made a comment, which was suppose that you could do with something like the evolving with the matrix product states. Suppose entanglement didn't grow. We know it does, right? But suppose it didn't. What happens is that in the way that we formulate this as a search, you could imagine that the circuit F is a black box, and you can actually map circuit satisfiability, which is a problem in NP, in that. So this problem of search would really tell us that, I could encode the y to be like one bit that says, okay, is the circuit satisfiable or not? So if I can determine that with an overhead, which is polynomial in the number of bits, times the computational cost of the black box, if the black box operated in polynomial time, I could actually solve the circuit satisfiability in polynomial time. So that's already a hint that there is a catch. But even though it's a very particular problem, like search, you can map many problems into search.
Okay, but my question, and this is because I don't know about that, is
mm-hmm.
how do you typically talk about the complexity of a circuit? What does it mean that the circuit is complex?
Okay, you usually in the circuit language is the number of gates.
But why? What answer? So this notion of complexity, I think we're talking about different notions of complexity.
Yes. Yes, I agree. For
so it's not the one is better than the other.
They're different.
For instance, one refers to how many elements you need to build that circuit,
mm-hmm.
right? And that is counted by the number of gates.
Right, but that's because it's a different measure. But what I'm saying is that you could imagine a circuit that has many, many gates, NAND gates, say because that's the building block, has order say n fourth gates, but has a very low density of crossings. So from circuit complexity, people will say, okay, the order of complexity of this guy is N4. But from, I would say, our perspective of thinking in terms of entanglement.
Simulatability.
Mm-hmm. Simulatability, exactly. But simulatability is more about the crossings of wires than the number of N gates. So in that sense, there are functions that you could imagine functions that have n to the 4 gates, okay? So it's bigger than the n square bound, but those are very simulatable. So that's why I think that, in practice, this could be actually maybe useful for many problems, right? So I think I'm almost at the end. Alyosha, you had a question?
No.
Okay. Some topics. Do all 2-bit gates increase bond dimension? No, there are some that don't. You can actually, sometimes you can decrease it depending on, let me give an example of something that never increases, the identity gate, okay? But you could, let me give another example. Suppose that I use copy and shift, okay? So I create a lot of entanglement because I now made a copy and send the thing all the way to the other end. Well, what if I just send them back, okay? I'm actually decreasing entanglement. So entanglement is not monotonic. You can find examples where you can grow and you can come down. Can we use truncation of singular values to limit bond dimension growth? Well, yeah, okay. That's something we've been talking about. We put the hat of the pessimist and use all the estimations without throwing things out. Yeah, you could do that. Of course, it doesn't help much if the entanglement is really growing, right? That's something that, Okay, a question that one could ask, can we do number factoring? Let me say that, okay, this is not, the answer is of course, well, it's no. But it's actually a subtle thing that you could imagine, first asking, and this we looked at in more detail. Suppose you have a function f we implemented. You take a and b, and you multiply a times b is a c, and you could count and you could do the search to find A and B in principle by doing this. Okay, what is the problem? Multiplication takes order n square gates, local gates. Okay, that's the other thing. Everything is local. There are algorithms that multiply that are use n log n. You find it in the literature. The only problem, and here's again exactly the thing you're discussing about the difference in what one calls complexity. You find, and people say, okay, it's n log n. But because you have a restriction of local gates, you cannot do n log n. Okay? Because n log n, because they assume that you can copy a whole register in with the computational cost is a zero. But here, copying a whole register is the whole worst thing you can do. But just to say, okay, well, we actually looked at the, we programmed the gates, and that's the other thing. Have you tested the method in practice by programming it? Yeah, so we did. We have a ripple adder, we have a multiplier, okay, just for the fun of it. And you can play with these things. So now, where to take it? I think it really depends on what one wants to do. If you think in terms of in the mind of a computer scientist, okay, well, that's what's the worst case scenario. But like I said, suppose you take an algorithm that the best algorithm is exponential. But can you come with an exponential that can you take a root of that by thinking in terms of the matrix products? Because as far as I don't know, maybe it is there in the computer science literature something that looks like this. I have no idea. Okay, but I think there is room for ideas from quantum information to feedback into computer science. Maybe help us design better algorithms, even if we fail to bring a quantum computer to life. At least there is a legacy of the knowledge accumulated. So. Thanks.
Questions? Any questions?
I already asked all the questions.
Let's think. Glad you're here.